The overall program falls into two distinct watersheds, so that there is something in the middle yet to be discovered, that on this side of it, the water drains one way, and on the other side of it, the water drains another way. So it's a watershed in the sense that the rivers drain into disparate areas, and those disparate areas may eventually be one ocean, but they're quite disparate from some conscious standpoint, yet to be determined, yet to be experienced. The first watershed, everything that happens is experience and has the character of wanting to come together. Its archetypal movement is to come together. And so experience has an intricative quality to it. That's what experience is really like. Distinct from that is consciousness. And the distinctive quality of consciousness is to differentiate. Just the other, the opposite, the reverse, or the complement to it. Consciousness of its own nature differentiates, whereas experience of its own nature integrates. So that in some basic way, some mysterious overall way, experience and consciousness complement one another. Now, generally what happens in that kind of a complementary relationship is that if you stress one, the other becomes unstressed. If you attend to one, the other is untended to the extent that you've attended to the one. The other becomes untended. And so, in a kind of like rote, easy way, we could say that they're heads and tails. Or, to use the I Ching designation, they're like yin and yang. Experience is like yin and consciousness is like yang. They tend to displace one another whenever one or the other is emphasized. So that if you put 90% of your attention on experience, consciousness is about 10%. If you put 90% of your attention on consciousness, only 10% is experience. So that if you go towards, say, approaching 100% consciousness, like in a higher mathematical formula, the experience level approaches zero. Or if you go towards 100% experience, like in some kind of ecstatic experience, consciousness, self-reflective consciousness, approaches zero. So they tend to displace one another. Notice that this also implies, very definitely, a kind of a corollary realization. That if experience and consciousness are exactly 50-50, your differentiating capacity and your integrating capacity are brought together. And if you can maintain the relationship in equanimity, differentiation and integration flow together as a ribbon which cannot be differentiated and also cannot be integrated any further. In classical language of yoga, this point is called Bindu. And technically, what is meant in the later Vedantic understanding of Bindu is that it's not a point that is there, but a vanishing point. That is to say, the difference between the two, where they come together in complete equanimity, the difference vanishes. And to follow just one step further, that would be the deep self. At that point would be the deep self, so that the deep self, in a way, is like a black hole of occurrence. Nothing further integrates, and nothing differentiates at all. Now, our first year is all towards approaching increasingly this point of vanishing. So we want to be attentive. And you must know that we're so inept at this that none of us are going to vanish. I haven't even come close to vanishing. But we're going to move in such a way that we approach this kind of experience. And so more and more, in your own personal lives, you may start to notice mysterious qualities beginning to happen. Like, if I may, Scott realizing in the last couple of days that there are some odd synchronicities starting to happen. Those kinds of occurrences are going to probably increase. It's nothing to fear, and it's nothing to become unduly curious about. It's just an indication, like a road sign. Yes, something is happening. And believe me that this process is very, very effective. And if you just let it be, it does its work. We don't have to put anything there. All we have to do is put in motion, in energeia and in dynamis, a durational sense in ourselves, and all of this will key in. It's all there. It's there already. So that this page, which has no headline, but reads at the top, notes, images, comma, integration, approaching a focus, and then the focus indicates expression, comma, resonance, ideas. And then at the very top, you'll see just a emblematic presentation of the focus as kind of like one of those cartoon flashpoints. You know, when Felix the cat gets stressed out, there are these little flashpoints that appear. Well, that's what that is. Not that the deep self is a stressed out flashpoint, but I'm just using that emblematically. Notice here that instead of differentiation, I'm using the term expression. And the reason for this, if we use differentiation, the word is loaded towards thought. And we have to watch out for ourselves. We're not afraid of thought. We're going to learn to think a lot better. But we cannot use a stacked deck to learn how to play a game. We have to use an unstacked deck because the purpose is not to win, but to learn how to play the game. If we use the term differentiation, we stack the deck and we win at the expense of understanding. This is the classic flaw in psychotherapy. This time next year, we'll be able to discuss a little bit why psychotherapy has a classic flaw in it. It is able to accurately differentiate and think about what it needs to do, but that advantage does not in any way help it to do it. In other words, in a colloquial way, the therapists are as crazy as the patients and cure themselves to the same 50-50 extent. Because there is a classic flaw in it. So we're using expression, and notice here that expression is an art term. It's a term in art. And one of the books that we'll get to, if you look at your pamphlet for just a moment and open it to next year to the art section, which would be on page 17. Page 17 of your pamphlet. The first book that we get to in art is John Dewey's book, Art as Experience. Art as Experience. Now notice that Dewey's book on aesthetics goes back to experience, but posits art as a kind of metaphorical stand-in for experience. The key term which someone must use in this posture, can I use that term for you? When you have this kind of outlook, that art as experience, then the natural term that you use for differentiation is expression. And the implied use of the term expression is that there is someone who is doing the expressing. Whereas the term differentiation implies that there is something which is doing the differentiating. And there's all the difference in the world, as you know, between something and someone. The something loads your methodology towards a kind of a procedural logic, and you can get buried in the niceties of correct thought. You can get jailed in it, as the 20th century has come to understand. And the 20th century is characterized in this mode by the plays of Samuel Beckett and the philosophy of Ludwig Wittgenstein, that everything, when it's loaded to that extent, logic will come to a tautological dead end. Because superior thought by itself always ends up in 100% limbo. And the simplest thing that thought has to realize before it commits that kind of limbo suicide is to remember that what is important is not to be right, but to live. It's important to live. And so the weight has to be given not to logic, but to an aesthetic. Now, one of the most acute minds of the 19th century did not understand this because he did not live this. And that mind was Soren Kierkegaard. And Kierkegaard is forever the greatest example of the saintly sage who forgot to live. But his thought is so acute and so religiously accurate, so excellent, that we can see the virtues, but we can realize the massive defect. The man never really lived the good life, though he could define it to the nth degree, perhaps better than anybody ever has been able to define it. But he didn't live it. And so it's like a version of the question that baseball players ask when you say, oh man, I had a fantastic day and I had 3 home runs and had 14 RBIs, and the question always is, but did you win? No, the team lost. It's the converse of that. It's not, you know, did you understand everything and you got it all down pat and everything? The question really is, what then did you do? How did you live then? So we need to pay attention to that, and all of this comes back to using the term expression rather than the term differentiation. So that you read into, for instance, if you start to read Carl Jung and he uses the term individuation, you read into that individuation is not a process of differentiation, as psychotherapy might say, but differentiation is a concomitant of a process of personal expression. It leads to a fuller result. So I'm putting this in at the very beginning now. This is only the fourth week. So that this does not bedevil us a year and a half from now. Now, one of the reasons why the history section was so unfruitful last time is because the students kept forgetting that it is they who are important and not their understanding of something. And so we need to tie a ribbon around our fingers. You are what is important, not your understanding. So my whole teaching mode is not to make things perfectly clear to you, but to elicit from you, at this particular stage, real experience of your own, so that you really have something to deal with yourself, rather than something to think about, or whatever beautiful kinds of ideational sketches I can make verbally. That's not the issue. So that then, underneath integration, focus, expression is experience, self, and consciousness. And I've then put the watershed here in this kind of a way, that experience is largely feeling tone, and consciousness is largely thinking tone. That experience tends to favor the operation of imagination, and consciousness tends to favor the operation of memory. And that for feeling, what often is the unspoken basis of it is sensation. In thought, the unspoken basis for it is insight. In other words, in order to take a step, you have to push off from a ground. The ground of feeling is sensation, and the ground of thought is insight. Conversely, the ground of sensation is feeling, and the ground of insight is thought. They push off one another. So that notice that feeling and sensation are pairs in a kind of a vertical orientation, but feeling and thinking are pairs in a kind of a horizontal orientation. Notice the square dance of the four functions. That the dance is the whole do-si-do of all the pairs making their rounds in a kind of an ordered ecology. And when we can be full of the experience of that entire dance and also conscious of that, then we have come a long ways towards being what we can be, being who we are. Now, there are some other things on here that have to do with our I Ching model that we set up. Thought is an experience only through imagination. In other words, thought is generally the quality of consciousness. How can thought enter into experience? It enters into experience through imagination. Now, in order to change this, in order to make it differentiated from just imagination, we can use a term that Henri Corbin used in translating some of Ibn Arabi's material, creative imagination. So you can amend this. Thought is an experience only through creative imagination. So you can just amend that there, put a little caret between through and imagination, and write creative. Thought is an experience. In other words, thought enters in and becomes an experience through creative imagination. Notice here that while dreaming is a form of imagination, vision, having a vision, envisioning, is a form of creative imagination. They're quite distinct. Vision is a high power of consciousness, whereas dreaming is a very basic power of experience. They're quite different. And when you're aware of these differences, when you're able to recognize phase, you'll see that the quality of happenings in your life becomes very interesting because, as the saying is, there's always a show going on. You've already long since bought the ticket, the whole bunch of tickets, and you're on all these rides, and even getting off the rides requires a ticket, and you've got one of those too. But it's a very complex thing. It's hard to tell whether leaving is a part of the carnival or not. The second line is that feeling is conscious only through remembering. Now, because we have used imagination and creative imagination, instead of putting memory down, I put remembering. You can amend that to be recollection, if you like, instead of remembering, because it's so close to memory. They're almost synonymous. You can say, put the carrot in there and say recollection. Notice that recollection and creative imagination have a complementary relationship. And that if you use one, the other is also being used at the same time. So that creative imagination and recollection are like the keys, they're like the polar axis of the interchange between experience and consciousness. They're the RNA messenger carriers, so that the hermetic function in ourselves is actually performed by creative imagination and recollection. Recollection here suffers somewhat because of its noun quality, and that's why I use remembering, because it's a gerund and has an active quality here. Now you can use, if you want to refine it for yourself, you can say it's not only creative imagination, but it's creating imagination. And creating imagination and remembering are these hermetic functions. So whenever you run across ascriptions to the hermetic tradition, it's the tradition of engendering the free flow of these capacities in a human being. Notice that there's nothing to be learned in terms of the subject matter, but there's everything to be engendered as life functions. So that creating imagination and remembering are necessary life functions for wholeness. There's no wholeness without these two operating and flowing freely. One of the conditions in which they exist are no limiting conditions whatsoever. Unlimited. And the unlimited condition is what we would call freedom in a colloquial way. What is freedom? Freedom is unlimited conditionlessness. Notice then that freedom has nothing to do with choice. It's a mental blur to think that freedom is having freedom of choice. Freedom is actually to see things as they are and to be as you are. That's what freedom is. It has that kind of relationship. Notice here that freedom is a quality which art in its pristineness actually generates. What is the socially redeeming value of art? It reminds us of the freedom of our being by introducing us to yet another way to creatively imagine and another way yet to remember. So it's very, very high function. One of the best statements ever on this was made about 200 years ago by a German writer named Schiller, and his little pamphlet on the aesthetic education of man is one of the world's great statements, one of the real high watermarks of intelligence on the planet, of someone who really did understand this. And a complement to Schiller's On the Aesthetic Education of Man is Shelley's Hymn to Intellectual Beauty. And those two, written within years of each other, are really fine statements. Discursive language raised to poetic levels of saying very precisely what one can really come to understand about this. I've ordered a new Oxford book, which is an edition of Schiller's Aesthetic Education of Man, but with all the commentaries and everything, it's $75. So it'll be a little while before I get it in. But I have several translations of it, and if you like, during the break, I can show you. Incidentally, Schiller had a very long correspondence with Goethe, and I think there are two volumes of the correspondence that are translated into English, about 1,000 pages, and in many of these letters, Schiller and Goethe talk about the meaning of just these issues. They were blessed by having someone that they could really talk to about these things, like Thoreau and Emerson, could really talk to each other about anything. It's a real blessing to have that kind of companionship. Now I'm going to let all of this go about unconscious and unexperienced. Let's look at the line, the interchange of creative imagination and recollection is like the interchange of fire and water in the I Ching. Now just think for a moment, fire and water in nature are the two universal solvents. In the alchemical process of natural transformation, fire and water are the two solvents. They're the two interchange points. So that when creative imagination is working and recollection is working, a kind of a solvent quality is occurring in our experience and in our consciousness. So that consciousness, instead of working by structure, tends to flow like a river. And the best, most precise language ever used yet on this is William James' language, that it seems like when you really get into this, that consciousness is like a stream. And of course, he was talking about this very high, refined, self-reflective capacity where his own creative imagination and his own remembering were functioning at peak performance, and he came to understand that consciousness is like a stream. Where does the stream of consciousness flow then? It doesn't flow towards more differentiation or more expression. It curves back and flows into experience. And what do you experience? What does the stream of consciousness experience? It experiences a kind of whirlpool-like quality of circumambulating a center, which is the self. So that if one could really be sharp, like Ibn Arabi, one could see that creative imagination also doesn't just then bring more and more experience to bear, but also flows and circumambulates in just the opposite direction. And so the deep self becomes defined by two interpenetrating whirlpools. So that the motion of creative imagination and the motion of memory are not straight lines so much, but they're like curves. Why are they like curves? Because they follow the contours of reality. Someone said, not knowing how accurate they were, there are no straight lines in nature. Now some of you were at, I hope some of you were at the lecture at Caltech on Wednesday night, when the great physicist Kip Thorne was talking about the protean insight of Einstein, that when you throw something, it seems to make an arc. But if the observer were to jump at the time that you throwed, and you could keep track, you would see that in fact it follows a straight line. it's only arced, it's only curved by virtue of the observer being in a static position. If you were able to see it, really, gravity doesn't pull it in an arc, but pulls it in a straight line. And if you jump at the same time you throw it, your experience of it, if you could record that, is that, in fact, it's a straight line. Which means that the structure of reality is not in the material expression of time-space where everything is curved. And that the reason why the deep self doesn't occur as a thing in time-space is that it doesn't belong to this realm at all. It belongs to the realm where there are straight lines. Now this is a little esoteric, but I'm trying to show you that there's a lot going on here, all right? Okay, we'll come back to the third page after we have this. Now I want to come to Thoreau. I'm going to start something and then we'll take a break. Notice how if we get into a philosophic investigation, it very quickly, at this level, jumps to a level where you have to really get on your tiptoes to just follow. Notice what we said before at the very beginning, that that procedure is fruitless. Because even if you could follow it to the nth degree is a limbo. It's a box canyon. The only thing that you come to, finally, if you follow that assiduously, is you come to appreciate the value of silence, of turning the mind off. It becomes a great virtue to be able to not have to think about it anymore. Oh, boy. Look at the intelligence of life, which exhausts us long before we reach the exhaustive stage by saying, well, this isn't very interesting, is it? And yet something deep down tells us, wait a minute, it is interesting. It's of the utmost importance. So both processes are operating here. The way to deal with this classically was to do an end run around both the resistance and the curiosity. And the way to do an end run is to generate a sphere of inquiry faster than the curiosity and the resistances can build. So you simply outstrip them. You outstrip the resistances and the curiosity by enlarging the amphitheater, and it was called in early Rosicrucian times, the term for this was the amphitheater of eternal wisdom. One of the great tomes in the PRS vault is Heinrich Kuhnrath's great Amphitheatricum Sapientae Aeternam. It's this generating of a field of inquiry, a spherical field of inquiry, faster than the doubts or the convictions can grow. So we're back into this process of generating our field of inquiry, which is actually a sphere. Now the first thing we're going to do is we're going to generate more curiosity and more resistances about introducing Thoreau. But Thoreau is going to be a part of our increasing field of inquiry. In the portable Thoreau, on page 109 is Civil Disobedience. So I'm going to give you a couple of excerpts from Civil Disobedience so that you can get this tone of Thoreau. This whole essay is a part of the classic esoteric American tradition. That is to say that the individual is the only reality in the social situation. Nothing else is real. so that if you want to do anything for real in a social situation, you have to go to individuals in order for it to be done. Anything done other than on that level is just adding mazes of illusion, and the process becomes more and more, as we would say today, cardboard or plastic. Cardboard is better. He begins, this is 109. He wrote this in 1850. I heartily accept the motto, that government is best which governs least. And I should like to see it acted up to more rapidly and systematically. Carried out, it finally amounts to this, which I also believe, that government is best which governs not at all. And when men are prepared for it, that will be the kind of government they will have. Government is at best but an expedient. But most governments are usually, and all governments are sometimes, inexpedient. The objections which have been brought against a standing army, and there are many, and weighty, and deserve to prevail, may also at last be brought against a standing government. The government itself, which is only the mode which the people have chosen to execute their will, is equally liable to be abused and perverted before the people can act through it. Witness the present Mexican War, the work of a comparatively few individuals using the standard government as their tool, for in the outset the people would not have consented to this measure. The Mexican War of 1846 to 1848 was a completely trumped up kind of a situation. It's reminiscent of everything from Vietnam back and forwards. In other words, this kind of misuse of government by an errant group superseding its individual basis is a classic problem in this country, this particular country that we have to deal with here. Now, jump to 121. I meet this American government, or its representative, the state government, directly and face to face once a year and no more, in the person of its tax gatherer. And Thoreau goes on to say that this is the only actual point where I as an individual come into contact with the illusory forms. And if I do not pay my taxes, they don't function to that extent. Their illusion doesn't carry on then to that extent. And that if enough do not pay their taxes, the illusion will collapse. Because it has no reality of its own. Now this incidentally became in during the long presidency of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, this became the rationale for the whole legislature, the whole Senate and House of Representatives branch of the United States government. They considered themselves not so much to set up laws, that's not where their power was, but in the ability to appropriate money. Because the realization came, all right, they can collect the taxes, but if nobody uses that collected money, then nothing is going to happen. And that's where the real power comes. This was not realized until after the First World War. So in a way, the legislature in the United States now works on a kind of an amplified subconscious Thoreau level, the Thoreau individual, which is unfortunate because that's not it at all. He goes on to say down here, I know well that if 1,000, if 100, if 10 men whom I could name, if 10 honest men only, if one honest man in this state of Massachusetts, ceasing to hold slaves, were actually to withdraw from this co-partnership, and be locked up in the county jail. Therefore, it would be the abolition of slavery in America. He's moved from taxes to slavery, because for him, slavery was the pristine issue. Can a human being who is a cosmic individual be held as property by someone else? You can see that in those terms, it's the ultimate non sequitur. Slavery became the ultimate non sequitur for Thoreau. Notice the language that he uses here. Where is this language from? It's from the Old Testament. The model of this is the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. If you can find 10 good people, the city will not be destroyed. Well, how about if you can find one good person, the city will not be destroyed? And of course, what happened? The city was just destroyed. There was nobody. Nobody at all. So Thoreau is very conscious here. He's using a lot of literary punch in Civil Disobedience. Now let's skip over to the next page, 122. Under a government which imprisons any unjustly, the true place for a just man is also a prison. This was the very phrase that struck Mahatma Gandhi. In an unjust society, the only altar to really worship God is in prison. The proper place today, the only place which Massachusetts has provided for her freer and less desponding spirits is in her prisons, is 1850. To be put out and locked out of the state by her own act, as they have already put themselves out by their principles. In other words, it's a them or me kind of a situation. Let's skip over to page 126. I have paid no poll tax for 6 years. I was put into a jail once on this account for a night. And in fact, the night that Thoreau spent in jail became a play about 30 years ago, the night that Thoreau spent in jail. If you get interested, I have a copy of it here by Jerome Lawrence and Robert E. Lee. Lawrence and Lee also did the play, I believe, Inherit the Wind, about the Scopes trial of in Tennessee, Man's Descent, Darrow, and William Jennings Bryan. Anyway, the night Thoreau spent in jail. But listen to how Thoreau talks about his experience in that night in jail. This is Thoreau at his universal best. He's like the phantom real person who is the only solid reality in a world of shadows. He writes this: I was put in jail once on this account for one night, and as I stood considering the walls of solid stone, 2 or 3 feet thick, the door of wood and iron, 1 foot thick, and the iron grating which strained the light, I could not help being struck with the foolishness of that institution which treated me as if I were mere flesh and blood and bones to be locked up. I wondered that it should have concluded at length that this was the best use it could put me to, and had never thought to avail itself of my service in some way. I saw that if there was a wall of stone between me and my townsmen, there was a still more difficult one to climb or break through before they could get to be as free as I was. I did not for a moment feel confined, and the walls seemed a great waste of stone and mortar. I felt as if I alone of all my townsmen had paid my tax. They plainly did not know how to treat me, but behaved like persons who were underbred. In every threat and in every compliment there was a blunder, for they thought that my chief desire was to stand on the other side of that stone wall.